Eisenhower was hailed as a hero of World War II, he was often viewed as an inept, do-nothing, inarticulate president who preferred playing golf to managing foreign and domestic policy. Our guest, Evan Thomas, says nothing could be further from the truth. Thomas is the author of Ike's Bluff, President Eisenhower's Secret Battle to Save the World. He writes that Ike deployed his skills of manipulation and deception that he honed as a card player to deal with foreign policy crises, the U.S. Congress, and even members of his own administration. His biggest bluff, Thomas contends, involved the threat of nuclear annihilation against the Soviet Union. Evan Thomas is former editor-at-large at Newsweek magazine, left a couple of years ago, now teaches writing and journalism at Princeton University, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
So how good a card player was President Dwight D. Eisenhower, or even General Dwight D. Eisenhower?
Too good, actually. He had to quit. He took off so much money away from his fellow officers that he was hurting his career. So he gave up poker and switched to bridge, where he didn't fleece anybody. But he was pretty good. He was so good that people didn't want to play with him. He was a little bit grumpy, I gather, at the card table. But he was a shrewd and foxy card player, and he used those skills as general and as president.
Did he have a poker face, as we call it?
He did. Well, he was smiling and benign. He concealed a big temper. But mostly, I don't think it was so much his face, it's just his ability to see around the corner and anticipate what's coming next.
And in that sort of cliche, holding his cards close to his chest.
He did not share. This is an important thing because he had this amazing capacity to hold personal responsibility. When you've run this, when you've been Supreme Allied Commander, and you've had to make the decision at D-Day, you know something about responsibility. There's a famous photograph that I think a lot of your viewers have seen of Ike talking to these paratroopers on the eve of D-Day, and their faces are all blackened and they're ready to jump behind enemy lines. He's gone there to talk to them because he's been told they're not coming back. That 70% casualty rate expected. So he wants to look them in the eye before he's sending to their fates. And he has in his pocket a letter he has written, which he will release. If the landings are a failure, the Normandy landings are a failure, he writes, "The responsibility is mine alone." So he had this, before he became president, he had this experience.
Did that serve him, do you think, as president, this sense of ultra-responsibility?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in his diary, his first night in office, he writes, you know, big problems, big responsibilities, big challenges, but in a way, it's familiar, going back even before 1941. So he's ready for it. Harry Truman, when he became president, apparently literally flinched when he saw the desk that Franklin Roosevelt had sat in. But Eisenhower was ready for it.
He had this volcanic temper, and it shows up. You write about it. It shows up in sometimes in these card games, often with his golf games.
Yeah.
Help us understand, and apparently a lifelong problem with his temper. How bad was that temper, and how much does that tell us about the man?
Well, he learned to control it, which tells us a lot. I mean, he seethed, but he controlled it. His mother, who was a fundamentalist Christian, would read scripture to him, and she would say to him, "He who conquereth his soul is greater than he who taketh the city." And Eisenhower would say to his aides, "Look, my mother taught me to keep my temper." And one of his aides said, "I thought what a poor job she had done." He was tough on his aides, but not when it mattered, you know, not with other generals or senators or political foes. He could control it. He had that benign smile and was sunny and warm and amiable. Nobody, the press didn't even know he had a temper.
But do you think it was a reflection of a certain kind of frustration that he had, or just a short fuse that he had?
He's human. You know, he's driven, you know, by who knows what. We could plumb his psyche, but he's definitely driven to succeed. And he's stirring and churning. It gives him the rocket fuel to reach for very high office. And yet he controls it because he wants, this is important, he wants to be underestimated. He wants people to think he's kind of not a dumb guy, but maybe not the quickest guy in the world, not the most sophisticated guy. He once said that he got ahead because by concealing his intelligence and his ambition.
That's a risky thing to do, is it not? I mean, clearly he headed the Allied forces and became the President of the United States. But nonetheless, to think of that as a strategy is strange.
Well, today, I mean, today, when everybody, you know, I teach these wonderful Princeton kids, and they are wonderful. But they're, you know, resume builders. They have to be. That's right. How they get in there. You know, they get these resumes that are as long as their arm. And they show off. not their fault. They live in a culture in which they are required to show up. Ike lived in an earlier time when you were supposed to kind of conceal your ambition and your ego. So it was a different cultural norm. But he just found it effective. I mean, he just is true today, true, that if you let other egos bounce off of each other and you kind of hide your own ego, sometimes, you know, it works better.
So this was a strategy
for
him.
It absolutely
wasn't just a kind of a default, but it was a strategy.
No, it was a conscious strategy. He had a huge ego. I mean, he was terribly ambitious. He talked in terms of duty, West Pointers, duty, honor, country. Those words meant something to him, but duty was the word he meant that others would, for which others would use ambition. He felt that it was his duty to run the country. You know, he was ambitious for himself, but for his country, and those things all came together. His service was to advance himself to run the country.
He sounded like a tough father, though. He had a son, and perhaps the son, the recipient of some of this temper.
Yeah, I know John Eisenhower was a wonderful guy, 90 years old, and he spent a lot of time with me. John Eisenhower has a sense of humor, like his father, actually. Yeah. And he begins, John Eisenhower begins his own memoir. The first sentence is, "I think I was born standing at attention." Think of it. His father's always, you know, correcting his deportment. That was a word that we don't hear that word much.
No, we don't.
Deportment.
I don't even know what it means.
And the eyes and everything. Your bearing, your manner, your posture, are you sort of standing like a soldier? And so, young John, when he graduates from West Point, the date is June 6, 1944. It's D-Day. Talk about being upstaged by your father. All through his life, he had to deal with this. But he's... John Eisenhower was a very smart guy and a very observant guy. And he really helped me kind of sort through his father. And we had my favorite moment, which I recount in the book, as we were talking about his father's temperament.
Right.
And the balance between the sunny, genial Ike and the cold-blooded Ike. And I said, 50-50. And John Eisenhower looked at me and he said with a smile, "Make that 75% cold-blooded."
Wow.
This is his own son. Now, he said that lovingly, but he meant it.
And he was cold-blooded. I'm thinking of his relationship, for instance, with his vice president, Richard Nixon.
Yeah, poor Richard Nixon.
Poor Richard Nixon, right?
Yeah, poor Richard. Nixon was chosen vice president, really, I barely knew him, but to be an ambassador to the right wing. Then as now, there was a powerful right wing in the Republican Party, and it was pretty isolationist and wanted to get rid of the New Deal and all sorts of stuff that Ike didn't want to do. Ike was a moderate internationalist, but he needed an ambassador to the right. And Richard Nixon was that man because he had credibility actually both in the center and the right of the party. The trouble was that they didn't really know each other, and very early in the campaign, 1952, Nixon got in trouble over this phony scandal over a slush fund. It was phony. I mean, there was a slush fund, but Adlai Stevenson, the Democrat, had a bigger one, and it was unfair to Nixon. And Ike, instead of standing by his guy, let Nixon twist in the wind, as they later said. And I really felt for Nixon in this because Nixon respected Ike and looked up to him. And here he's not getting much love or support from Ike. And Nixon saves himself with the famous Checkers speech, which your listeners probably remember some of them and certainly know about. Kind of mawkish, but very effective. And Nixon saves his job, and he's not thrown off the ticket. But Ike waits and waits and waits and finally says, okay, to Nixon, "You're my boy," in a kind of condescending way.
Wow. Yeah. His relationship with Mamie Eisenhower is very interesting to me. And in part, I mean, I was a kid of the 1950s and have this sort of vague image and memory of the two of them. And to an outsider, she had that sort of dowdy. First lady of the 50s look about her. But they had real chemistry, as you write about.
I mean, Susan, their granddaughter, pointed out to me that they were the first modern presidential couple to sleep in the same bed.
Yeah, interesting.
And when Mamie confided in Susan, she talked about, I don't think she went into their sex life because I don't think you did that with that generation. But Susan said, she dressed carefully for Ike to accent her bosom and her waist. And, she wanted to be sexy. And I think she was to Ike. I think that was a real marriage.
And how do you think he viewed her, Mamie?
Well, he lovingly, but it's complicated. He is a man's man. He has stag dinners. This is the 1950s. He's grown up in the U.S. Army, a male world. He does not discuss business with her. I think John or Susan told me they had a truce that business was for Ike. You know, the world's affairs were for Ike, and Mamie ran the house, and there really wasn't much discussion. But in Ike's doctor's diaries, there's a daily diary that his Ike's doctor, Howard Snyder, kept that details Ike's mood and a lot about Mamie too, because Mamie's worried about Ike's health. And there's a lot of bickering and fighting. But there's scenes like they've been bickering all day, and then Snyder notes that at 4 o'clock in the morning, Ike, who's been sleeping in his dressing room, comes and crawls into bed with Mamie. I mean, it was a real marriage. It has its ups and downs, as real marriages do, but there was a lot of love there, too.
But it seemed that Eisenhower also did like attractive-looking women.
Sure he did. I mean, he had a famous unclear whether it was a physical affair or not, but with Kay Summersby, most of your listeners are aware of this. World War II, he's off in England, and he has this beautiful Irish driver. She was kind of as a driver and his assistant, and everybody speculated that they were sleeping together. Very unclear about that. I have actually had my doubts.
Really?
Because Ike was such a Victorian. This is a little bit maybe too candid for a radio conversation, but Kay Summersby wrote in her second memoir that they tried to make love once and he couldn't. That has the ring of truth to me. A Victorian gentleman who really was guilty. Everybody else is sleeping with their assistants, but he wasn't. But maybe one night he has an extra scotch. He tries. He can't. You know, clearly there was emotional intimacy between Kay Summersby and Ike. This is hardly unusual. I mean, Douglas MacArthur had a mistress. Patton had a mistress. I mean, who didn't have a mistress over there in World War II? But I think that there's no doubt that Ike loved his wife. He signed his letter to her, "Your lover, Ike." Yeah. And they, however damaged their marriage may have been by World War II, they put it back together again.
And it sounds like a lot of your research drawn from letters and from diaries and a kind of paper trail, because there seemed to be something a little bit unknowable about Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Yes, I mean, he sort of liked it that way, I think. Mamie said, you know, I never really knew him. His own wife, I never really knew him. John, when I sat down with John, the son, he said, well, I never really knew him, but we'll try to figure him out together. I mean, he was quite candid about it because Ike intentionally did that. He kept a part of himself that nobody could see. In a way, this is a story about leadership.
Yeah.
The great leaders really can't open up to everybody.
We're almost up on a break here, but do you think he was a lonely man?
Absolutely, but a very self-contained man, and he dealt with his loneliness through his own kind of rigor and self-discipline.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation, talking with Evan Thomas today on Radio Times. He teaches writing and journalism at Princeton University after a long career at Newsweek, and he's also the author of a new book. It's his eighth, and it's called Ike's Bluff, and it's subtitled President Eisenhower's Secret Battle to Save the World. We are going to take a very short break and then talk about some of the foreign policy challenges that President Eisenhower and the country had to face. Also talk about the fact that the 1950s was not that kind of smooth and boring time that is often described. We're also taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY. Independence Blue Cross is dedicated to transforming healthcare to make a better coordinated system that is built around you. They're committed to leading the way to focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it, pioneering new ways to pay healthcare professionals based on the quality of care, and using technology to update your medical information electronically so everyone can be informed. Further details online at ibx.com. Independence Blue Cross, changing the game.
Best songs, best comebacks, best records of the year so far. Like a lot of music fans, Jim and I make lists all year round. But come December, there's only one list on our minds, the best albums of the year.
This week on Sound Opinions, Greg and I reveal our picks for the best albums of 2012, and we hear some of yours.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Congress is debating what to cut and what to keep to avoid the fiscal cliff. But what would happen to your financial picture if tax write-offs for mortgage interest and charitable donations come to an end? We start our series looking at fixes for the fiscal cliff and ask, why not? Next time on Tell Me More.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Evan Thomas. He was editor-at-large and Washington bureau chief for Newsweek magazine, author of a brand new book called Ike's Bluff, President Eisenhower's Secret Battle to Save the World. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. It's interesting to think of Eisenhower going from general, a very popular general, coming back to the U.S. in the 1950s. You say he had a kind of disdain for politics, probably didn't even vote. Why did he want to be president of the United States?
He said he disdained politics, but of course he was a great politician. You don't get to be Supreme Allied Commander unless you're pretty good at politics. He had an instinctive feel for it. He felt that he was, in a way, the most, some would say, the most popular guy in the world at the, in 1945, all over the world.
Sure.
And he felt that as the communist threat was building and the country was in danger, he felt a sense of duty. I know that sounds kind of melodramatic and really egotistical, but he saw a sense of duty that he was. He used to carry around a poem called "The Non-Essential Man," that which he carried around to prove, because he believed he was essential. You know, he was indispensable. I'm sorry, it was the indispensable man. That he was indispensable, that he really was the guy who could save the country. He wasn't totally wrong in that.
But was his overall goal to prevent another world war or prevent the nuclear annihilation of the world, to be dramatic here?
He felt, when his first day in office, his desk drawer is locked. They get a key. There's a report in it written by Robert Oppenheimer, who developed the atom bomb. And he said, the United States and the Soviet Union are about to reach what they call nuclear plenty. Each side will be able to put 2,500 bombs on the other, and civilization as we know it is going to cease to exist. The United States and the Soviet Union, said Oppenheimer, are like two scorpions in a bottle waiting to sting each other to death. That was the burden on Dwight Eisenhower. He actually considered, in his first several months, doing a preemptive strike on the Soviet Union before they got enough bombs to kill us. That was the atmosphere of the time. And Eisenhower saw himself as a peacemaker. He had seen war. He hated war. Like a lot of real warriors, he hated war. And he was damn sure he was going to avoid any war to keep us out of a nuclear war.
But what's so interesting is that he threatened nuclear annihilation as a kind of perverse or inverse way of trying to keep
peace. He did. It's hard to get your arms around or your head around. But you have to look at the way he did. He had seen a lot of war, obviously, World War II. And his reading of Clausewitz on war, he was actually surprisingly intellectual, was that small wars become big wars. That politicians who think they can control little wars are kidding themselves.
And there's some truth to that, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely, as we have found out to our displeasure, to our pain. Anyways, he saw that, and so he didn't want to get involved in any war. But he's not a pacifist. Communism seems to be on the march in that time. You look at a map. Eastern Europe turns red. China turns red. It's, you know, Southeast Asia. It's everywhere. And the United States is not going to just go home and leave Europe. And so he sees these confrontations coming with the Soviets. He doesn't want to fight with them conventional weapons because he thinks that'll get out of control. What are you going to do? He bluffs. He bluffs with nuclear weapons. He basically says, don't try us, don't even think about it, or we're going all the way. And so that, for instance, when Berlin, you know, which is sort of a hot point of the Cold War, and the Russians were trying to kick the West out of Berlin, looks like there's a crisis, 1958, 1959. Eisenhower says to his cabinet, you know, this is, he uses a poker analogy. We're not going to be starting with the white chips, you know, conventional troops going up to the blue chips, nuclear bombs. I'm putting my whole stack into play, was the expression he used. It's all or nothing. That's the only strategy I have. And he said, this is not going to be some nice, sweet World War II kind of war. So he played this kind of heavy hand. Now, only Dwight Eisenhower could get away with something like this. You had to be this supreme Allied commander, this general who'd won World War II to get away with this bluff. But he did. Now, what's so interesting to me, and which really is most of what the book is about, he carried all this in his head alone. He didn't share this with anybody. He didn't tell anybody. I started writing this book because I heard that his closest aide, General Goodpaster, said, you know, Eisenhower never told us if and when he'd used these weapons. He kept this all to himself. I thought, wow, What is that like to carry that kind of responsibility?
Well, on the one hand, you have to have supreme confidence in your position, but you also have to think that the other side will blink.
Yes, you right? sure do. I'm using these card analogies. He called the bluff of the Soviet Union. Khrushchev, your listeners will remember Nikita Khrushchev, who was a very scary, blustery guy, would say, "We will bury you," and pounded the table at the UN with his shoe and talk about having rockets and all that kind of stuff. Khrushchev was a scary guy, but Eisenhower knew how to deal with him. And the way to deal with him was not to back down and to meet him and to talk to him. And he gradually got Khrushchev to calm down. But he could only do that from a position of strength. Khrushchev was only going to understand it if Ike was backed by a real by rockets, by real missiles.
You also say that Eisenhower really was his own Secretary of Defense. He had a Secretary of State. He had a CIA director, but sort of acted or operated as his own Secretary of Defense.
He did. He did. This is a good thing about Eisenhower that people overlook. Eisenhower knew the military. He actually cut defense spending in the 1950s. Think about it. This is very counterintuitive. The great general, when we're building up for the Cold War, cut defense spending. Now, he did it from a high level of the Korean War, but he cut it. He did it while building an enormous strategic air command and missile fleet. He did it by cutting his own army. His own service. Now, it takes a pretty big ego and pretty big confidence to do that, to irritate, to put it mildly, annoy your old comrades in arms from World War II. Matthew Ridgway quit as Army Chief of Staff because he couldn't bear Eisenhower's cutting of the army. So Eisenhower had this, because he knew the Pentagon, and only like nobody else did, he was able to cut it.
The idea of cutting it, if you cut it, then you won't use it? I mean, was that his thinking, which sounds rather simplistic?
Yes. For instance, when they're having this great to-do over Berlin in 1958, and there's Khrushchev has issued an ultimatum. The West must be out in 6 months. And everybody's going, "Oh, well, we have to build up our conventional forces and get ready to fight." Eisenhower cut conventional forces in Berlin by 50,000. Oh. And nobody could believe it. What are you doing? And what he was doing was he was bluffing with nuclear weapons. We're not going to have a conventional war. It's all or nothing. He called Khrushchev's bluff.
And that's Evan Thomas, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's called Ike's Bluff, President Eisenhower's Secret Battle to Save the World. And again, our guest, Evan Thomas, teaches journalism at Princeton University, spent many, many years as a journalist himself, many of those years at Newsweek magazine. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get William from Allentown, New Jersey to join us. And William, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. When I was in the service, I was with the Chemical Corps, and because of some knowledge of German, I was translating papers captured during World War II. Now, this was in 1960-61. And getting help on doing that, I occasionally interfaced with some of the Germans that were with von Braun. And I heard an interesting story, and I've never heard about it, on something that Ike had done. The United States was, they said that we had fallen behind in a space race, et cetera, and all the rest of this. And von Braun had wanted to put a satellite, which turned out to be the Explorer, into orbit around the world. Eisenhower knew that the Russians were going to put up Sputnik, and he told von Braun he could not put up his satellite until Sputnik, because he wanted Sputnik to go over the United States, and by doing that, it would allow future satellite surveillance, etc., of Russia. But if we put up the Explorer first, he felt that the Russians would, you know, bring things up and would be problems. Well, and he very much wanted to do it that way.
Well, William, that's really interesting.
It is really interesting. I've heard that. I know that's the theory, and I think it's just like Eisenhower to allow the Russians to sort of – what looks like a defeat is actually a victory. Because once the Russians have a satellite going over us, they can no longer dispute whether we can have a satellite going up over them. I never heard, though, that Eisenhower specifically told von Braun this. I know von Braun was frustrated because he was ready with a booster. He could have beaten Sputnik with his own Redstone booster, I think it was called, and he was held back. But I thought that there were other reasons for that as well. I didn't know that it was explicitly put to. But it's possible that Eisenhower told him that. I'm a little doubtful about that, but it's possible.
William, thanks for the call to Radio Times, and again, you can call as well. That phone number 1-888-477-9499. Let me ask you about the Dulles brothers, John Foster Dulles, head of the Secretary of State, and Alan Dulles heading up the CIA. What was their relationship with each other, and what was Eisenhower's relationship with the two of them?
Well, a lot of power to have both the Secretary of State and the CIA in one family, so to speak, a brother act. And the CIA was very aggressive and involved in the 1950s, and Eisenhower was fine with that because, since he didn't want to fight conventional wars, he used the CIA to fight secret wars on the cheap, small. At first, it looked like it was going okay. Coups in Iran and Guatemala. Now, in retrospect, those coups were a disaster. But at the time, it looked like it was a kind of cheap, simple way to check communism. As the 50s went on, the CIA had less success. There were failed coups in Syria and Indonesia. And Eisenhower, in retrospect, should have fired Alan Dulles. But he doesn't. And it's because he says it takes a strange kind of genius, as he says, to run the CIA. And Alan Dulles was that kind of a genius, a great spy in World War II. But also because his brother is Secretary of State. And it's a little bit hard to get rid of one brother without getting rid of the other. And Ike liked John Foster. So I think this is a failure on Ike's part. He should have gotten rid of Alan Dulles and exercised greater control over the CIA. It comes back to bite Ike, because the CIA withholds the fact that the Soviets are building anti-aircraft missiles that can shoot down our U-2 spy plane. This is important because we got this great U-2 spy plane going over Russia. The Russians can't touch it for a long time, but then they can. And they actually do shoot one down right on the eve of this summit meeting in 1960, and it's a terrible blow to Eisenhower because he thinks he wants to have this summit to get with Khrushchev, to create detente, to cool off the Cold War. Once that U-2 is shot down, Khrushchev makes a big show of, oh, we've captured the pilot and all that. It's the end of detente. The Cold War begins a very dangerous period. So the CIA really let down Eisenhower by not telling him the truth about what the Russians could do.
But as you say, looking back at some of those small war, you know, Cold Wars of the 1950s, even in the 60s, you can see their legacy today.
You can, and it's unfortunate. I mean, you know, even in the 50s, people started to suspect the CIA was everywhere.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, it's those Yankees, the CIA. And so it made us seem like a more malevolent power than we actually were. We could be a malevolent power in some ways, but not nearly the degree much of the so-called Third World, as we called it in those days, thought we were. So it had an unfortunate legacy.
You quote John Foster Dulles, who seemed to enjoy the kind of brinksmanship that Eisenhower was about.
He did. I mean, it was a complicated relationship. Eisenhower used Dulles in a good cop, bad cop way. He let Eisenhower let Dulles be the kind of heavy, say, you know, massive retaliation, brinksmanship. And the press, which was lazy in those days, maybe even lazier than today, thought that Dulles was making foreign policy. He wasn't. Eisenhower was. But it was useful for Eisenhower to let Dulles be the front man, even though, as we now know, Eisenhower was writing the key words in the speech.
Dulles saying, just as you must take chances in war, the ability to get to the verge without getting into war is the necessary art. If you cannot master it, you inevitably go to war. Basically saying what Eisenhower believed.
But it's all kind of blustery at the time.
Yes.
And people thought, oh my God, they're going to get us all killed. And Eisenhower just sat back playing golf and, you know, seeming kind of dopey. And, well, you better talk to Foster about that. But Eisenhower was running the show.
I do remember because I was a kid in elementary school in the 1950s, the kind of, you know, duck and cover.
Yeah.
The silliness, in hindsight, obviously, duck and cover
didn't
feel
so silly at the time, did it?
No, but it was a scary time.
It was scary. It was. I'm born in 1951, so I grew up in the same period, and I was scared to death.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we were allowed to be too scared. I think Eisenhower probably could have done a better job out of reassuring us that the Soviet missiles were not about to fly. But, you know, it was the time, and you always make planners always make for worst-case scenarios, and the Soviet threat was real. It wasn't imagined. I mean, they had, you know, nuclear bombs, and they were building missiles that could kill us all. They weren't as powerful as we thought they were, but they were still scary.
You write about Joseph Alsop, who was a very powerful columnist at the time, and he was writing about this
missile gap,
the Russians were, or the, I should say, the Soviets were beating us in the.
Yeah, it was bogus. I mean, in the 1960 election was won partly by John F. Kennedy alleging there's a missile gap, meaning that the Soviets have more missiles than we do. There was a missile gap, all right, but it all ran the other way. We had way more missiles than they did. Sputnik scared everybody because the Russians put up the first satellite. So we thought, oh, my God, they're going to be raining atom bombs down on us from outer space. And the country was panicked by it. And Eisenhower tried to calm everybody down, but he might have done a better job of calming people down. He wasn't really that effective at that time.
But as you say, also columnists, I think LBJ, others were sort of feeding into this
gap.
Well,
he got politicized. I mean, some things never change. We think that politics were responsible then and they're not now. No. LBJ, a great politician, used this phony missile gap to increase his own political power, to get votes for Democrats. The Democrats, which we think of as the party of peace in later time, was definitely the party of war in this case. They wanted more defense spending, and Eisenhower, behind the scenes, was holding back defense spending.
Did he have, you know, did he have contacts and relationships with members of Congress at the time, either Republicans or Democrats?
He did. I mean, more than Barack Obama, I'm sorry to say.
Well, I was wondering about that. I mean, I was thinking about
Barack
Obama.
No, he met on a regular basis up on the Hill with congressional leaders. He played golf with Bob Taft, the Senate Majority Leader, with whom he was not getting along, and after they played golf, they got along better. I mean, this sounds so trivial, but if I would say one thing to President Obama, it would be play golf with John Boehner.
He did once.
He plays a lot of golf, but usually with his pals. He played golf with Boehner, Congressman Boehner, once.
Right.
He could stand to do more. I mean, I know this sounds silly, but, you know, that's how people befriend each other. And, you know, in the old days, they used to have drinks together and all that. They don't really do that so much anymore, and I think something is lost.
I have to say, though, your descriptions or other people's descriptions of Eisenhower playing golf, throwing his clubs, yelling and screaming, and his doctor, I think, was often his golfing partner.
He didn't yell and scream that much. I'm a little defensive here about this.
He was
grim. He was grim. He wasn't fun to play with. One time, it's true, he threw his club at a poor Dr. Snyder and almost broke his leg. Now, it happened to be the same day he was deciding whether to fly the U-2 over Russia. So he was carrying this enormous weight of responsibility, and because he is human, it showed in an embarrassing way on the golf course.
Again, we're almost up on a break here, but it sounds like he paid a kind of physical price for carrying all this information so closely and privately and secretly, really.
A heart attack, a stroke, a stomach operation. He wasn't young. When he left office in 1961, he was the oldest president ever, first one to reach 70 in the Oval Office. Think of all the strain he'd been under all those years. He smoked 4 packs a day until 1949 when he gave himself an order to quit, as he put it, and did quit smoking. But he was beat up. He was worn out. By 1960, he was done.
And that's Evan Thomas, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about Dwight D. Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, the subject of his new book called Ike's Bluff, President Eisenhower's Secret Battle to Save the World. And we have a bunch of callers that want to join us at 1-888-477-9499. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll get back. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Tate Weller, Certified Public Accountant, celebrates 90 years of specialized audit, tax, and advisory services to national and global nonprofit and financial services clients. TAITWeller.com. Tate Weller. Focus. Expertise. Results.
Yuck, they're greasy.
I know, Michael said. They're not as good as my mom's.
A fourth grader fries his own latkes and cooks up a small miracle. And an uncertain young life is mysteriously redirected. I'm Susan Stamberg. Join me and Murray Horowitz for the 2012 edition of Hanukkah Lights from NPR.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
Most children subjected to sexual abuse feel great shame. For male victims, shame can be front and center, so much so that their stories are often untold. After all, how does a grown man reveal this part of his life? And if he does, is help available? On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, stories of male survivors, how they're recovering and thriving. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM. Supporting WHYY, Trader Joe's, traveling the world to source a variety of foods and beverages like ready-for-your-toaster Belgian waffles, made in Belgium. Locations at TraderJoe's.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. And if you're just joining us, Evan Thomas is our guest. He currently teaches writing and journalism at Princeton University, has been busy writing himself. He's got a new book called Ike's Bluff, President Eisenhower's Secret Battle to Save the World. And we have just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. And not to keep going back to President Eisenhower's stomach problems or even his physical problems, there was a time, though, it seems later on during his tenure in the White House where he was taking pretty strong sleeping pills, maybe drinking a little bit too much.
Yes. I mean, he normally limited himself to 5 ounces of scotch a day, taken in measured doses. But a couple times in his doctor's diary, he says to his doctor, let's get drunk. And he's feeling the pressure. And he is, you know, sleeping pills in those days, second all, was a barbiturate. You could be hungover. So I think today, I don't think he'd be prescribed those today.
Right.
Now, he's a strong guy. I don't want to overstate this. He's not reeling. He's not talking to the portraits. Dwight Eisenhower is a vigorous, tough, smart guy. So he may have had a sleeping pill or too many, but he was in pretty good shape.
Let me get Gregory from New York to join our conversation. Gregory, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
My question has to do with Iran and the oil fields there. In the late 40s and early 50s, the changing political system in Iran threatened British interests in the oil fields. And Truman was approached and asked if he would effect a coup, and he declined that offer. And then when Ike got in, the British government approached, or a British interest again approached the president, and Ike went for it. And that was affected in the end, I think, by Kermit Roosevelt, the grandson or great-grandson of. And I was wondering why Truman did not go for it, and Ike did. I'm going to hang up now and listen for my answer, and thanks again.
Thank you, Gregory, for the call.
I mean, oil was a huge factor, of course, and the Brits were more successful at getting to their old friend Dwight Eisenhower than Truman. That's all true. But it's also true that Eisenhower thought there was a communist threat here. Now, they exaggerated that. Mossadegh was probably not the crazy commie they thought he was. But in those fevered times, you could be pardoned for thinking there were communist threats where they were not as great as they might have been. They made that mistake as Guatemala as well and in other parts of the world. So in retrospect, that coup was wrong. We shouldn't have done it. At the time, it looked like the right thing to do.
Gregory, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And it's interesting about how a decision made back, 50, 60 years ago has resonance today. We've done so many shows about Iran and that overthrow.
Looms large.
Very, very large.
Yeah. Although, that movie I saw, what was it called? Which is a wonderful
Arco.
Movie. Arco. They make it sound like they're all happy Iranians, and then the wicked United States came along. I don't think that's quite right either. I'm not so sure they didn't have their own problems. You can overstate this.
Let me get, looks like Philip from the Northeast to join us on Radio Times. And Philip, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, my question is this. During the McCarthy period, when Senator Joe McCarthy attacked General Marshall, who had been Eisenhower's mentor, and appointed Eisenhower to be head of SHAEFE, during the personal attacks that McCarthy made against General Marshall, Eisenhower did not rise to defend him. He never said a word about it. He just let it pass.
Yeah.
I find this to be a very strange and sort of spineless response to the man who made him what he was. Would you comment on that, please?
Yes, I mean, your view was shared by Ike's own aides, many of them, that Ike should have stood up for the sainted great General Marshall when McCarthy attacked him. It was a crass political moment. They actually took a line out of a speech in Wisconsin in 1952 where Eisenhower was supposed to defend Marshall, and he did not. Now, in defense of Eisenhower, Eisenhower's view, and he said this to his own aides, was, I'm not going to get into the gutter with that guy. I'm not going to elevate him to my level. I'm not going to get in a, excuse my language, pissing match with a skunk. And I'm going to let him hang himself. Now, it took 18 months. And that's too long. And lives were hurt in that period. But it's also true that McCarthy did hang himself, that Eisenhower was able to preserve his political power and his ties to the right, did not get into a mess with McCarthy that could have really disrupted the whole country. So Eisenhower took the long, the subtle, the behind the scenes, the hidden hand view of it. You can argue with that, as his own aides did, but the end result was Ike came to a cabinet meeting after McCarthy had been censured by the Senate. Ike said, you heard the latest. McCarthyism is McCarthy wasism.
Hmm.
So he took a kind of pleasure in bringing down McCarthy his own way.
But do you think there was, I don't want to use the word cowardice, but do you think there was a kind of passivity about him?
Yes, well, we can endlessly debate this. I mean, one person's passivity is another's wisdom. And Ike would have argued, look, if I get into a fight with this guy, it's just going to elevate him. It's going to divide the country. You're going to have this crazy, drunken red baiter in the wrestling match with the President of the United States. What good is that going to do us when we have all this other stuff to do? So he let him sort of slowly hang himself. It took time. He should not have allowed McCarthy to besmirch General Marshall's record. That was a mistake. But overall, you know, I think you can defend Ike's method of bringing down McCarthy slowly and subtly.
Philip, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Excuse me. Most of your book is about foreign policy and the various foreign policy threats from the Soviet Union and even in parts of China. But you also write about civil rights, saying that President Eisenhower didn't moralize about civil rights and used indirection to deal with some of the threats of the civil rights.
This is a little bit like McCarthy. I mean, he did not use the bully pulpit. It's true. He didn't say, listen, everybody, desegregation is here. We got to get over it. He was more subtle than that. But behind the scenes, he did a lot. He desegregated the armed services, even though Truman gave the order, was Ike who actually did it. He desegregated the District of Columbia. He appointed the federal judges who did this desegregation in the South. When a governor, Orville Faubus, stood up to him in Arkansas and refused to desegregate the schools, Ike didn't kid around. He sent the 101st Airborne. So he was to uphold the Constitution. He introduced the Civil Rights Act of 1957. He did a lot, but he did it behind the scenes. He thought we had to move slowly on this, that the country wasn't quite ready for it, but that if you make slow, patient change and use the rule of law, that you can get from here to there. Again, you can argue with this, but it's not like Ike was doing nothing. He was doing it his way.
But do you think the fact that how he grew up, and I guess the time when he grew up, also his long military career, and then, of course, he spent 8 years in the White House, that he lived in a terrarium?
Yes. I mean, he grew up poor in Kansas, so he saw the world there. And the military is the world in a way, but it's a male world.
With orders.
With orders.
And hierarchy.
And hierarchies. That's true. Ike had good human feel. He was very good about human nature, so he wasn't remote in that sense. But look, he had entourages of valets and colonels and people looking after him, and he was dressed in the morning by his valet. So yes, and his buddies tended to be millionaires who liked to play golf with him. So yes, I would say he was removed somewhat, but he had such great human understanding that it cut through a lot of that insulation.
He famously warned about the military-industrial complex, but as you write, it originally, I guess, said military-industrial-congressional complex.
Yeah.
Congressional or Congress removed.
The Iron Triangle, which definitely includes Congress. He didn't want to antagonize Congress, so they left that piece of the equation out. But he did presciently warn against it. In fact, he'd really been working against the military-industrial complex through his whole presidency. We mentioned this earlier, but he cut defense spending.
Right.
And he restrained the hawks, who in those days were liberal Democrats. He did a lot. He just didn't advertise it until A couple of days before he left office, he gave this famous speech that has become a iconic speech.
Yeah. And removing the word Congress because it was too loaded? Or?
Yeah, well, don't get into a fight with Congress about this. Yeah, I mean, it was implicit in what he said. I think everybody who thought about it and understood that Congress was part of the problem.
He had some famous, I guess, recorded conversations with President Kennedy, of course, yeah. Came after him, some about the Cuban Missile Crisis, talking about not getting involved in wars, and then, of course, we get involved in the Vietnam War.
Yeah,
did that trouble him?
Oh, yes, because he was an all-or-nothing guy. And he thought about Vietnam. If you're going to do Vietnam, go all the way. Invade. Declare war. Take Hanoi. Or don't do it at all. Now, that's not the way Kennedy and particularly Lyndon Johnson saw it. They're politicians. They thought you could have half a war, three-quarters of a war, gradual escalation. Ike didn't believe in any of that stuff. But he let himself be used by LBJ. He's old. Ike's older now. He's on his sixth or seventh heart attack. Ike reveres the presidency, and so LBJ would trot him out at press conferences to support the presidency and the president, and he ended up supporting policies that he didn't really believe in. This gradual escalation was not Ike's idea. He was against it, but he was too old and too sick and too loyal to fight against it publicly.
Was he a great president from your perspective?
Absolutely. I mean, maybe he's not up there with Lincoln or Washington, but he's the next notch down. That was a dangerous time in the 1950s. And Ike had a great sense of personal responsibility and wisdom and courage. And we're lucky that he was there because we might not be here if he hadn't been there.
You write, like Lincoln, Eisenhower could be moody and temperamental, but also like Lincoln, he was supremely confident. He was not the confident of the weak, the arrogance of the vain, and needy, and going on from there to describe.
That's an important point. I mean, a lot of arrogance comes from weakness. I know when I'm arrogant, it's because I'm afraid. And when I'm confident, I'm more likely to be humble. Eisenhower had the humility of the truly confident.
Which is something interesting to think about, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is. I wish we all had more of it.
Let me see what Joe from North Wales has to say. Joe, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I was in the Marine Corps in February of 1955, which followed the fall of Dien Bien Phu in 54.
Wow.
I've always credited Eisenhower with the wisdom of seeing what a quagmire Vietnam would develop to be. And I want to know if that's a fairly correct assumption.
Yeah.
Joe, thanks for the call to Radio Times.
Absolutely. In 1954, when the French were asking us to intervene in Vietnam with ground troops, and a lot of Ike's advisors wanted to do it, Eisenhower said the jungle consumes armies by divisions. He was not about to get ground forces involved in a jungle war in Vietnam, and he didn't.
Yeah.
He avoided it.
Something I didn't know about General Eisenhower, even President Eisenhower, is while he had this long military career, he never personally saw combat.
Yeah. He missed World
War I. I
don't
know if that's unusual or not.
Yeah, well, it is for very senior guys. You usually have to have that patch, that check that box, you know, been through that ordeal. Eisenhower missed World War I, and then, of course, by World War II, he knows too much. He knows the secret of Ultra. He's too powerful. They can't let him onto a battlefield. But he saw a lot of battlefields after the fact when they were still steaming and stinking. And he saw all the horrible detritus of war, the rapes, the indiscipline. The United States had the most disciplined army in history, but, you know, they're young men and they're afraid and they make mistakes. And Eisenhower saw what war does to people. And he flew in a small plane from Berlin to Moscow after the war, over the path taken by first the German army and then the Russian army, and he saw not a single building left standing. Mm. And he thought, this is what war does. And he was darned if he was going to get America into another war. And that was his great legacy. He did not commit combat troops while he was president. After he got us out of Korea, no more combat. And no other modern president can say that.
I was reading, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that your grandfather was a pacifist?
He was. Norman Thomas was a socialist and a pacifist. And when my father went off to war in World War II, it gave him a wonderful letter. It said, if God is disappointed in us men and our ways, so must be the devil in the face of such courage and comradeship as plain people show. My father always kept that letter from his father.
And was your grandfather a Socialist Party candidate?
Yeah, six times for president.
He ran for president.
He did. I mean, it was a it was serious. He never got more than 800,000 votes. He lost 32 to FDR, I think 20 to 1. That was the best he ever did.
Wow.
But he was very idealistic, and he carried a torch for things that have become commonplace now: anti-child labor laws, minimum wage laws, all those things that were the socialist platform in the 1920s are law today.
And your father was at D-Day?
My father was at D-Day in the U.S. Navy on a LST at Normandy Beach. Yeah, he was.
Did he talk about the war, your dad?
He did, sort of, but like a lot from that generation, he didn't talk about it a lot. I mean, it was very important for him. We talked about Ike being humble, the confidence to be humble. That was definitely a message I got from my father, is the truly strong people are humble. They're not showing off. They're quietly confident. That was a good message. I haven't always been able to live up to it, but I sure wish that I had.
And do you feel like Vietnam was your war as a kid growing up?
I missed it. I mean, it's weird having a father who'd been to war when you haven't. I was class of 73 at Harvard College. Nobody then went to war because I had a high draft number, high deferments. But I always felt slightly uneasy about that, you know, my father went off to war. I didn't. Now, I didn't. I was against the Vietnam War, but, you know, an awful lot of young men who worked in service stations and had high school or didn't have high school, how come all those people were going to fight? And all of us Harvard boys were sitting around our dormitories being all moralistic about it, but not having to fight. That left a disquiet in me that I feel today.
And do you think Eisenhower could get elected today?
No, because he's too moderate. He's a moderate Republican. He couldn't even get nominated today. I wish that wasn't true, and I'd like to think that people would see that light. But he was a liberal by modern Republican standards. He was way too far to the left. I would hope the Republican Party would be wiser than that, and maybe they would be, and maybe they will be in the future. But right now, it doesn't look that way.
Well, on that note, Evan Thomas, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. And the book is called Ike's Bluff, President Eisenhower's Secret Battle to Save the World. And Evan Thomas spent a number of years as a journalist working at Newsweek magazine. He now teaches writing and journalism at Princeton University. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us. Do stay with us, though. We'll be right back. Do stay with us for the second hour of Radio Times. We'll be talking about lessons learned and not learned.